Hi everybody, welcome to this episode of Enlightenment Today. I'm Jason. Today we'll be speaking about the soul. So what is the soul? Now in both in the East and the West, they would agree that the soul is the psyche, but both view it differently. You know, in the West, we often think of our soul going to some place called heaven after death, where we play a game of poker with Mahatma Gandhi or George Washington and so forth and so on. But is this really what the soul is? You know, and that's purely from a Christian context, but a lot of people still do think that their soul goes somewhere else as their personality into another alternative realm at death and so forth and so on. But when we look at the East, how do they perceive the soul? Now, first we need to understand some key concepts in Sanskrit in the East. So first you have Atman in Sanskrit. Now, Atman means undifferentiated consciousness, the non-dual self with a capital S, which is identical to the ultimate reality that we call Brahman. Now, Brahman is that divine energy of the universe that animates the whole universe, gives it life, which we can't really give a name, which they gave the name of Brahman, but it's what you would say is the Godhead or even the Tao in Taoism in China. So a lot of people assume that Atman itself is the soul when Westerners start to read especially Sanskrit scriptures, the Upanishads, the Vedas, the Yoga Sutras, and the Brahma Sutras, and so forth and so on. But as I said, Atman is actually the undifferentiated consciousness. Now, when we look at Hindu and Buddhist, they often, you know, they get into a lot of arguments about whether there is an Atman and so forth and so on. And in Buddhism, they have the Sanskrit term Anatman. So Anatman means no self. Means there is actually no personality in reality, no ego. But the argument between Hindu and Buddhist is really just semantics, because when you get down to the deep down essence of both of Atman and Anatman, they're basically the same, because in Hinduism, in Vedanta and Yoga, Samkhya and so forth and so on, Atman is when you've begun to refine your personality, your consciousness, down to the ground of your being, which is the nature of the universe, which is Atman, which is identical with Brahman, which means there's no sense of ego there, which is exactly the same as an Atman. So it's not really anything that they should be in argument about, and we don't need to debate those terms. But neither actually refer to a soul. When we talk about a soul in Sanskrit and in the East, we need to talk about the word Jivatman. Now, Jivatman is a combination of two words, Jiva meaning individual and Atman, as I said, being undifferentiated consciousness, the non-dual self. And this is the combination of the individual personality and Atman. So the mixing of those. Now, in the East, it's the Jivatman, which is the soul. It is that which in the East that they perceive that reincarnates. Now, a lot of people in the West don't believe in reincarnation, but there is actually a science to reincarnation. So it's the Jivatman that is reincarnated. But what is the Jivatman? But we need to understand that. We need to look at the science of reincarnation, which is actually the Wheel of Samsara framework. Now, the Wheel of Samsara framework is a complex system, a complex science of understanding the psyche, understanding our consciousness, and what it is that is reincarnated, and how to, in the East, there's always the emphasis on transcending the soul, transcending the personality, so that we don't have to be reborn again. So first of all, what is samsara? Samsara is a word that you can use for suffering. It's related to time, and also it's samsara is kind of a word to emphasize our mortality, the suffering we encounter in our life due to our limitations, our own mortality. And we often suffer from life circumstances that are out of our hands. And you know, this is the Wheel of Samsara. So the Wheel of Samsara framework is, you know, people often think of samsara as, you know, the wheel, the turning where we come back life after life, until we realize the game, basically, until we realize that we are Atman beyond this Jivatman, beyond this soul. Now, this constant turning, this wheel of samsara, is what eclipses another Sanskrit term, eclipses nirvana. Now, nirvana can mean extinction, it can mean freedom from suffering, and it really relates to the eternal reality that we experience within our consciousness that we call enlightenment. Now, that's obviously, nirvana means then that your consciousness has come to a stage, almost what I talked about with the Atman, where it's undifferentiated. It doesn't identify with partiality anymore. It's completely impartial and it sees reality in itself as one, though it still does acknowledge the duality in it. This is kind of the eyes of Brahman, the eyes of Tao, the eyes of Tathata in Buddhism. Now, this Wheel of Samsara framework is what continues to build the soul life after life. It begins to keep us in the idea that we are this personality. But again, like I said, the East didn't think of the soul in the sense that the West did, as a specific personality. So to understand the science of Samsara framework, the Wheel of Samsara framework, we need to understand three key concepts. So the first concept is samskaras. Now, samskaras is the mental impressions and subliminal psychological imprints we have within us. Now, we develop samskaras over our life, which sink deep into our subconscious, and this builds the two limbs of samskaras. Now, the first limb of the samskaras is vasanas. Now, vasanas is a Sanskrit word which means latent tendencies or ingrained habits. Now, these vasanas, they, because of the samskara framework, and you remember the samskaras are deep within the subconscious, this is what tends to make us unconsciously have these habits to act in the world, which builds the second limb of samskaras, which is karma. Now, don't think of karma in the sense of cause and effect, because karma literally means action. It comes from the Sanskrit root kri. Now, how this works then is that the samskaras that we develop in within us that sink deep within us from our experience, some could say even from our genetic blueprint, are what we begin to, they're the tendencies we begin to gravitate towards, they're the habits we begin to develop, which fuel our actions in the world. For example, if you've had a bad experience with a certain individual 5 years ago, that would have gone deep within your samskaras, which begins to change your tendencies and habits about how you deal and act, your karma, with how you act towards other people. But the problem here is that when you see that same individual 5 years later, they have completely changed, and you should not judge them on their past experience. And this is what the East has nutted out, because they realized that we need to dig deep into these samskaras to be able to see life purely objectively at all times, because everybody is changing moment to moment to moment. We can't judge everyone, you know, on the surface from what happened 5 years ago. The Wheel of Samsara framework is a method to transform our samskaras, but we have to understand our vasanas and our karma. So when we talk about our action, we ultimately in the East, they want to be free from karma, free from the unconscious actions in the world that often cause them suffering. It often leads to suffering. So they want to transcend that. So to do that, instead of the samskaras emanating out from within our being into the world through our vasanas and karma, we need to reverse the motion from our action through our tendencies back into our mental impressions and our subliminal imprints, psychological imprints. And this reverse of motion, this reorientation of focus, is what yoga really is. This is the yoking of the personality to reveal Atman, to reveal Purusha deep within us, to reveal that pure awareness, unstained, where we see the world as it is without our subjective viewpoints of how we think the world is. So how do we develop this reverse action? And there are methods and tools in the Wheel of Samsara framework to reverse this motion from karma back into vasanas, and then to ultimately transform the samskaras. Now, there's two key tools or methods to develop this practice. First of all, you need to develop the ability of viveka in Sanskrit. Now, viveka is discrimination. Viveka is the ability for you to reside more in your pure awareness and see your mind reacting to the world, but being conscious of your mind reacting to the world, or even your own self, your mind reacting to trying to build guilt within yourself and so forth and so on. So your ability to see this without reacting accordingly. So you're just developing the ability to observe your mind. This is viveka, and it's a common practice in Advaita Vedanta. This is what actually mindfulness is in Buddhism. Now, the benefit of this is you begin to develop the second method, the second tool in the Wheel of Samskara framework, in the reversing of that, and which is vairagya. Now, vairagya means non-reaction. You could say it means not getting stirred up with what's going on out here and also what's going on within here. So this practice of vairagya, what they want you to do in the East is that when you are living your life just in every day, when there's situations happen to you, if even if they're you discern them to be good or bad, you don't react to them, or you don't overly react to them. And what this does is it starts to dig in to your unconscious actions. It starts to dig into your karma, which begins to transform your vasanas. It begins to transform the way that the habits and the tendencies you have towards the world. This is the point of vairagya and viveka, because you begin to transform, you know, actually your samskaras, your deep down, your subconscious, what you think is your personality. You begin to actually transform that to reveal, as I said, the Atman. So basically what you're doing with viveka and vairagya is you're sort of cutting off the juice to the unconscious habits and actions towards the world that fuel, you know, all of those unconscious actions and habits. So you're cutting off that juice because you're reorientating your focus, and you've reversed the motion of from going out from your samskaras to going back in. Now, the point of this is to get down to the deeper level, down into the sensorium of our being. Now, this is the sensory root level of the psychosomatic organism. Okay, it's where we observe the vibratory flux of sensations within our psychosomatic organism. This is known as a vedana in Pali, to observe this vibratory flux within us. Because once you start to reorientate your focus back within yourself, you start to be conscious of your unconscious habits and your unconscious tendencies and your unconscious actions, then you start to get down into the deep level of the samskaras, because samskaras on the deepest level affect our senses, affect our nerve fibers and our psychosomatic organism, our body and our mind. So once, you know, this is what Vipassana meditation is all about, actually, in Theravada Buddhism, is to practice Vedana, to practice the awareness, the observation of your sensorium within you, and how your senses are attuned to acting a certain way and thinking a certain way. So this is a really deep process of transforming the samskaras. Now, complementary to Vedana, you need to practice what is known as Anapanasati. Anapanasati is the awareness of respiration, the awareness of breath. So this is what enhances the process of being conscious of the sensory level of your being when you practice Anapanasati. Now, when you continually do this for a long time, a lot of people know this from practicing mindfulness just in their everyday life, you begin to transform your samskaras. You begin to be more conscious of the sensory level of your being and how that is attuned to acting a certain way. So when you begin to do this a lot, this is why, you know, a lot of people emphasize that at least, you know, once a year we should go somewhere for at least a month in seclusion, because this, you bring your mind and your body back down to the sensory level to realize how you're attuning your life to other things. But, you know, Buddhists and Hindus and the Taoists, they go even further and they dedicate their whole life to this process. But when we dedicate our life to this process, or we become more conscious of this, this is when we begin to transform our samskaras, you know, to the point where we can avoid any new samskara reaction of craving or aversion, which in the end gives us the experience of the ultimate reality that we would call Brahman, Dao, or Tathagata. You know, you get down to that level where you've dug right down into the samskaras to the base of it, where is that ultimate reality, the Atman, which is Brahman, we could say. Now, so why they practice in this Wheel of Samskara framework is because the idea of the soul, the Jivatman, is actually just a bunch of tendencies and habits and actions that are ingrained in the samskaras that cling to the Atman, cling to the non-dual reality, which is perpetually coming back. It's perpetually, it's like it's energy. It's an on-off switch. Once you die, you come back, so forth and so on. So the idea is that these tendencies and these habits are actually what come back life after life. It's not your persona per se. It's what fuels your persona. I'm not going to come back in my next life as Jason and have all of these beliefs I have and these desires I have and so forth and so on. What comes back is these ingrained habits and these actions and these tendencies. So this is what builds our personality, the samskara framework, the matrix of samskara. So the point of this wheel of the samsara framework to transform samskaras is to burn out those latent samskaras that make this so-called personality that you think you are, which keeps you separate and isolated from everybody else. So the practice of Viveka and Vairagya is very significant in getting down to the transformational aspect on the sensory level of the samskaras. And this is where you start to begin the process of what the East believes, and where this will be your last birth. You won't be reincarnated again, because you have begun to refine your consciousness so much that your mind is like a pure jewel, as they use the word jewel, but it's completely empty. It's come back to Purusha. So this is the end of the cycle of death and rebirth, actually. And the soul itself, according to the East, has been transcended. It's been left behind, and you are left stark naked as Atman. You are not Jivatman no more. You are that which was before your birth. You are that which was before time, which we all are, and which comes on as one, as everything, and animates as everything. So to articulate this a little bit more, the Eastern thought, if we look in the Tibetan tradition, the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and we look at the great classical text of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, they talked about this end of rebirth through three phases. So what they emphasize is that, through your life, you should be doing sufficient self-work to begin this process, begin the Wheel of Samsara framework, begin the process of digging back into your samskaras. And when you continue to do this through your life, you're becoming more humble, more compassionate, more virtuous. These are the characteristics of the divine reality, the divine ground of all being. And so when you begin to do that, you begin to help the world, but you also begin to not act selfishly and so forth and so on. So as you continue towards the day that you die, as they say in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, when you go into samadhi at death, there's three phases that we can all go through. Now, the first phase that we all go into, according to them, is a complete void that we cannot imagine. Now, this void, a lot of people would say is analogous to purgatory, but this void, there's completely nothing there. Your consciousness is just there, it's present, but there is no identification with anything. Now, if your habits and your tendencies and your actions were strong in your past life, what begins is there's a second level under it, a second phase. So if they were strong, the vibration of those begin to drag your consciousness back down into this next phase. Now, this doesn't mean that you're going to be reborn in this next phase. You still have an option to, apparently, to recenter your focus, your consciousness, to get back up into your level and then to transcend back into the source of all reality. But if the habits and the actions and the tendencies were strong, you're back in the second phase. And then if it becomes too strong, boom, you're back into the first phase, which means you are back into the womb. You are going to be reborn again. This is how the Tibetan Book of the Dead nut this process out. So we can only speculate what happens if we remain in that first phase, that first void. The idea is that if you remain in that, like I said, you go back into the the source of all creation, that divine ground of being that we call Brahman, Tao, Tathata, the Godhead, call it what you will. Now, this is why, because of this process, this is only one process in the East where they kind of have a elaborate conceptual framework of what happens after death. The Tibetans actually believe this is what happened because they had, back in the day, skilled practitioners who could go into the death experience and come back and almost bring back postcards from that eternal reality. They had this also in Egypt. That's why there's the Egyptian Book of the Dead. There were certain processes. But in the East, this is why it's important to practice samadhi when your time has come to die. When I say samadhi, meaning practicing stillness meditation, practicing complete concentration in the present moment, being completely here and not worried about the people you're going to leave behind, how sad that is, you know, how are they going to do without me here, and all of these things. It's about coming back to that great opportunity, they say in the East, to go into samadhi as we go into the experience of death. Now, this leads to another Sanskrit term, which is maha samadhi, which means the great samadhi. Because if you do this and you have lived a life, a virtuous life, like I said, refined your consciousness, become more humble, more compassionate, more forgiving in your life, loosening the grip on your personality, then you reach this state of maha samadhi, meaning, as with the Tibetans, you go from that void experience back into the divine ground of all being, back into the Brahman, back into the Tao, back in Tathata, so forth and so on. So this is the process that we go through as a so-called soul, which according to the East, as I said, is just an accumulation of tendencies and actions that have not been burnt out of our samskaras. They have not been transcended. So that's why we come back life after life. As Buddha said, you know, a lot of people come back life after life because they have not burnt out their desires for certain things in their life. They have not transcended those desires and those habits to seek those desires. Instead, when we look at the East, we should be ultimately looking for contentment, which is free from all of that. When we are completely content with our life, then we don't have to be concerned about those desires, even though we can pursue them, but we don't pursue them with the fervor that we do in the modern day. So again, as I said in this episode, everything to do with the soul in the East is not so to do with the personality, it's more so to do with the karma and the vasanas that are the limbs of the samskaras. And the process of yoga is to reverse that motion, dig back in to the samskaras, transform it, get down to the sensory level where you transcend your personality, your sense, strong sense of personality, and you merge with that which we cannot give a name. Thank you for listening today.